This is Frank Coletta, and you are listening to Gangland Wire. And if you're ever in Vegas, take the Frank Coletta Casino Tour, 702-622-0850. Thank you.
Hi, it's Aaron from Gangland Wire. When Gary's not here, I break open the beef jerky, but not just any jerky. I break open the Jurassic Jerky. That's right. Go on over to JurassicJerkyLLC.com and put in your order for some tasty snack meat treats. If you love beef jerky, then you've got to get the carnivore candy from Jurassic Jerky. Put in the promo code GANG10 and you'll get 10% off the entire purchase order. There's my order coming in now. Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out here. We're in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we have a really special show. We have a friend of mine, this guy, Ron Chepsik. He gave me kind of my first shot at the big time, shall we say, after I finished my documentary film, Gangland Wire. He invited me to be on his show. He has a crime radio show. So let's go ahead and introduce our good friend from, I can't remember where you're from back east, I believe, Ron Chepsik.
I'm here in the heart, in Dixie. I'm in South Carolina, Rock Hill, South Carolina, which is outside Charlotte. It's a little hamlet just outside Charlotte, about 30 minutes from downtown Charlotte.
Well, welcome, Ron. I'm glad to have you. I remember now that you were in the South. I've got a bunch of stuff here about you on your bio, but I glanced down and I thought, oh my God, where is he from? I know he's from somewhere in the South or the East or something. Well, anyhow, welcome aboard. You want to tell the folks just a little bit about yourself, your background and your radio show, and how did they get onto that?
I've been living in South Carolina for more than 3 decades. Came down here for a job at the university. I was a university professor for several years before becoming a full-time freelance writer. I'm originally from Canada, Thunder Bay, up the frozen tundra up above Minnesota. When I grew up, I thought everybody wore 3 pairs of socks. And when I went away to college, when I was about 18 years old, I realized they didn't. So I have a radio show called Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. And I've been doing it for about 6 years. I'm also a full-time writer. I've published more than 40 books and about 4,000. I've sold about 4,000 articles. And I'm a screenwriter now. I've moved to screenwriting. I've got 4 screenplays optioned, and I've got 2 of them in development right now. And I'm trying to get a deal on 3 of my books, which have been optioned for movies as well.
Wow, you've been busy. You know, tell me a little bit about the screenplay. You mentioned the one about one of the original black gangsters in the United States, Frank Matthews.
Yeah, yes, we have Frank Matthews. I don't know how much your listeners know about him. He's one of the best-kept secrets in organized crime. I always call him the Black Al Capone, because I think he was the first really big black gangster in U.S. history. Bumpy Johnson of Harlem fame gets more attention, but Matthews was the first really, really big gangster that the government focused on. He became the object of the biggest manhunt in DA history. And at 29 years old, he disappeared with a beautiful woman and reportedly with $20 million. He was never seen again. He vanished off the face of the earth. There are no snitches to tell where he is. There are no fingerprints. There are no photographs. And so it's a really incredible mystery. And that's one of the books that I did. And I've also spent a lot of time researching Colombian history as far as the war on drugs is concerned. And I've been doing that for almost 3 decades when I was on a junket, a press junket, with some other journalists. And I missed a connection back to the U.S. In 1987, April 1987, and met a woman who became my wife eventually. And that brought me back again to Colombia numerous times. You know, I had family there after I got married and all that, and also a lot of interest in Colombia because Escobar was running wild at that time in the late 1980s, you know, embarking on what became known as a narco-terrorism campaign. So there was a lot to write about, and so I focused on that, and eventually, I was thinking, well, there should be a book on the Cali Cartel. So much print has been spent on Escobar, you know, and he was important, but I said the Cali Cartel was probably bigger than the two cartels and the more dangerous in terms of its impact. And finally, when I didn't see anybody else doing a book, I decided to start it, and it took me about a couple of years to do it. I was a professor at the time, so I was working full time at the university. And the book came out in 2000, and about 2003, I updated it when the two main leaders of the Cali Cartel were extradited to the U.S. in 2006, which officially ended the history of the cartel. And and then when Narcos came out, the series, there became some really keen interest in the Cali Cartel. And so my book was optioned. It's been optioned in the UK with Maverick House, and it's been optioned in Italy with another big publisher. And so that's where I am, and I'm here on your show, I guess, because of that.
Ron, we appreciate you being here, and that's there's a huge appetite for true crime, as you know, and I know, and
yes,
people never grow tired of it, and they need new stories all the time, because I've noticed with this podcast, they consume one and they want another one. They consume one, they want another one. The same way with books, and I'm the same way. I consume one book and I want another one, and I want something different, and, you know, the same old. So this Frank Matthews, it's kind of got me intrigued a little bit. Let's go into that just a little bit. Now, what was the name of the book that you wrote that was about him?
Black Caesar, The Rise and Fall of Frank Matthews Kingpin.
Now, was he from Chicago? You called him the Black Al Capone.
Oh, he was very interesting. He was born in 1944. So if he was alive today, he'd be like 73 years old. He was born in February. He grew up in Durham, North Carolina, which is a small southern town. And interestingly, you would be amazed at how many major black gangsters were born in North Carolina. Bumpy Johnson, and South Carolina, Bumpy Johnson was in Charleston. You had Frank Lucas, who was born in North Carolina. You had Ike Atkinson, who I also did a book on, who was a really big drug trafficker. And you had Frank Matthews, who was born there also. He was always an ambitious youngster, and at a very early age, he decided to go north to seek his fortune. He ended up, after a spell in Philadelphia, ended up in Harlem. And this was, you know, in the mid-60s when heroin was becoming really big, you know, on the U.S. scene, and the French Connection was breaking up. It had a really strong stranglehold on the heroin trade. And that opened up opportunities in neighborhoods where black gangsters operated to become much bigger dealers. And Matthews tried to break into the trade. He actually went to the mafia to get money and provision. They turned him down. And so he had a friend, a Cuban named Rolando Gonzalez, who gave him two kilos of heroin. He had to jump bail. He went to Venezuela. So with that two kilos, Matthews got a start, and he had an international connection with Ruben, with Gonzalez in Venezuela. So he became one of the first big international drug dealers in U.S. history, and he brought heroin from Venezuela. He worked with the Corsican Mafia, which is quite interesting. The Drug Enforcement Administration didn't have any clue that this guy operated. First of all, they didn't think black gangsters could do that. You know, there was a little bit of racism involved. And second of all, there weren't that many black gangsters on the scene at that time with that kind of stature. And so it took a little while. Incredibly, a cop was living in the same building as Matthews, noticed some activity going on with looked like drug deals, did some investigation, and exposed Matthews. And so that started the investigation of Matthews. It took about 3 years. During that time, Matthews became the first big black drug trafficker that operated outside of his own hood. He operated in 21 states, which at the time was pretty big. And he had set up like franchises in each of those cities with a major dealer that he worked with. He was only 29 years old, and you know, he looked like he was untouchable. He was planning to get out of the business. He was buying up legitimate businesses. He was hoping to get out. Through a series of incidents, he got on the radar and got busted. He jumped bail in 1973, July 2nd, right after, just before July the 4th, and disappeared. And we can trace him up until about 9 months to a year that he was still alive and still operating. Then he disappears off the face of the earth. I write in my book, one half of my book deals with his active life as a gangster, and the second half deals with the investigation, which was incredible because they spent enormous amount of resources trying to locate him. Gave a reward, biggest reward since John Dillinger back in the 30s. It was about $25,000. Which doesn't seem like a lot of money today, but at that time it was. They never had a lead. And I interviewed first the two DEA agents that were assigned to try and investigate him. When it was turned over to the U.S. Marshals, I interviewed the two lead marshals that spent 10 years investigating Matthews and had nothing to show for it after 10 years. It was just an amazing case.
That's a heck of a story, Ron. I think Aaron's question here.
Well, Matthews was such a—he was bigger than life. You know, he was like Al Capone. He had a personality, or like John Gotti. He was, bigger than life. And everybody has a story that I used to interview people. A likable guy. Everybody liked him. Very generous, and all that. He could be really mean. He was a tough guy when he had to be, but he's just a charismatic, really interesting individual, and. To do all that and then disappear when you're 29 years old, just off the face of the earth, right. It's just amazing. And so the book's been optioned, for a movie, and hopefully something will develop out of that.
Well, I was just kind of interested because this was 1972, and $20 million, if you put it in today's money, would be a lot more than $20 million.
So. Yeah, I translated it to, it came out to about between 90 and 100 million.
And then, so he opened up in 29 states. He had like a drug franchise. Is it true that it was called SmackDonald's?
That's a good name. SmackDonald's.
That's a good one.
He was actually 21 states that he operated in. 21 states.
He was the Ray Kroc of drug dealers.
The Ray Kroc of drug dealers.
Yeah,
he said.
Right.
Hey, Ron, exactly. I have a question about that from my own experience. And I remember in the early 70s, and I worked the inner city, the heroin dealers were black, and we didn't really have any cocaine that we knew about, and there'd be weed houses out there. But when he branched out, did he reach out to other existing black heroin networks? Like, I know we had one in Kansas City, and probably every major city did, because the Italians, after the French Connection, for sure, I think all the remaining Italians got out of it. They weren't really supposed to be in it too much anyhow. So was it all, did he reach out to other blacks, I guess is my question.
Yeah. As one DEA agent told me, the Italians didn't like to sully their hands, on the street with the stuff. They like to give it off to, the black dealers, which opened up opportunities. Two things. First, you mentioned cocaine. He was a cocaine addict before his time. That was one of his problems. He loved cocaine, and this was like in the early 70s before, cocaine came big in late 70s, right?
Right.
So, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, that's when it really became a big thing. So he was ahead of his time with that. And he also had a heart problem. You know, he had a heart palpitation. One of the prosecutors told me that. And what's interesting about that is that one of the stories that circulated about Matthews was that one of his girlfriends told the agents that he had gone to Houston to get a heart transplant. And they thought it was a crazy story, right? But you had to check it out, you know. So they went to Houston, and it made sense because Houston's a major center for medicine, right?
Right.
You know, some of the great doctors and hospitals are there. So they checked out all the hospitals, and they couldn't find any connection to him. But that was one of the weird stories. The second thing about the heroin dealers, yes, they worked with people in that were emerging in these neighborhoods. In Philadelphia, they had a problem because the black mafia was emerging at that time, and so they ran into conflicts, and they literally chased Matthews out of Philadelphia. They killed one of his leading connections there, and so Matthews didn't have much success in Philadelphia. But in a lot of the other cities, he did. He hooked up with, and that's how he operated. You know, he would go in like a salesman, and find out who had the ability to market his drugs, and he had the connection, right? He had the connection in Venezuela, and he still dealt with the Italians a little bit. They had a love-hate relationship, the Italians and Matthews. If you want, I could get into a little bit about that, because that's another fascinating story about Matthews. But yeah, he did connect with the black dealers in the neighborhoods, and he knew how to work with people. That was one of his assets.
Now, the one thing about the Italians, and we had this in Kansas City, even in the cocaine trade, and they won't ever deal directly. Our guys here wouldn't deal directly, but through and not even through a made guy, but a close associate by marriage of the couple of the higher-ranking people here. And he was investing money into a black cocaine dealer and, you know, in tri-sacks full of cash, and then that guy would go turn it into the cocaine and head the distribution network. Yeah. So that's probably what same thing was happening there.
Yeah, it was a pattern, you know, probably all over the country, you know, as the drug trade was changing. And as you and I mentioned about the French Connection breaking up, you know, their stranglehold that they had on the distribution was loosening and opened up opportunities. Of course, there was a lot of other factors going on, too. It was the, you know, the Black Panthers were rising, right? Black militancy and all that. So the dealers in these neighborhoods are becoming much more aggressive and militant than they were, say, 10 years before. In the early 60s when the French Connection was riding high.
How strong was the DEA at that time? I mean, you're talking late 60s,
well,
early 70s. Were they really at the level, you know, they were running around using index cards like Gary Jenkins?
Yeah. Well, see, that's interesting because, you know, they said that he fled with $20 million. And I asked the DEA agents I interviewed, I said, well, how sure are you? You know, what kind of proof? And they said they estimated, because he found out he was banking about $1 million a month for about 20 months before he fled. So he was anticipating that something was going to go wrong and that the law was going to get onto him. So they did it from that, you know, that they figured that. But actually, there was no real way to really definitively say, yeah, he took that much money with him. Another interesting thing to show you how primitive the times were. There's a story that he actually used his draft card to hop a plane and left the country. You know, you didn't need a passport at that time to do that.
Yeah, really. We interviewed one of the early skyjackers, and he was talking about how he went around and looked at different airports and figured out that, you know, all he needed to do was put his gun inside of a attaché case and walk up and buy a ticket and get on.
Yeah, exactly.
And he parachuted out with $500,000.
He didn't bring a parachute with him on the plane. Maybe that was odd that a gun was not suspicious, but a parachute is.
Yeah, it was different. You know, we first started focusing on cocaine dealers in Kansas City in a more organized manner, in a more professional manner than the good old days of, you know, rock and roll, right, and pop somebody and go on. And And we went out, we had a crew go up to the airport and ask about, give them some names. And the people at the airport were real helpful, a little less, I don't know. They were just, they just opened everything up to us. And they, and so they showed them these pictures and had them check these names. And somebody else walked up, a regular clerk on a, I think it was it Delta? The regular airline from L.A. to Kansas City. And this guy said, oh, yeah, he said, that's our drug dealers. He said, they come in here all the time. Well, thanks a lot for telling us. Well,
they were probably getting paid off, too.
Exactly.
No, they just didn't get it. They just didn't get it and know what to do with it. Well, it's this whole drug business has been an interesting ride for the United States, hadn't it, Ron?
Yeah, well, yeah, and it's been a total failure.
Really,
though? You know, if you look at Nixon was the first one to declare war on, you know, war on drugs in the early 70s, and then Reagan did again in the early, but, you know, nothing to show for it. It's just been a, you know, it's a classic example of idiocy, you know, keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result.
Really, you know.
And what's happened, it looked like under the Obama administration there was going to be a shift, you know, to loosen, you know, laws against marijuana, legalize medical marijuana, but under Trump, it looks like it's going back to the dark ages with Jeff Sessions. He has absolutely no clue about what's happened, you know, the last 40 years.
It does look like it. We had a guy who, he was Mr. Narcotics when I was on the job. He was the captain and then the major over all the narcotics investigation during all this time. And he did a big Jamaican investigation, and he came on and told about that. And then he went to work for HIDA, which is High Intensity Drug Task Force.
Yeah.
After he left the PD, and he spent another 10 years working HIDA, and rose up to like over all the Midwest. And he said, basically, you know, he said, this is crazy. He said, they need to put money into treatment and take it out of law enforcement. And
exactly.
He said,
exactly.
It's just not working. And this is a guy who was in the know. He made an entire career and a hell of a good living because he was in upper management the whole time. And you know, he says it was just what we did basically was all bullshit.
Historically, you know, the U.S. has put about 2/3 of the money into trying to stop supply. And they pay lip service with the other third of the total amount of money to demand.
Well, but so I mean, you're talking about an epidemic of mass consumption that has really kind of spawned from being, you know, if you want to say the, you know, the French Connection of heroin into cocaine to now. Now where you get a franchise, it's Crack Donald's.
Crack Donald's, and now it's the whole opioid thing.
Yeah.
So opioids.
The biggest drug dealers in the world today aren't the Mexican cartels, it's the pharmaceuticals.
Or the doctors. You know,
legal drugs.
Yeah,
we have legal
opiates. I mean, the opiate crisis, you know, which is really shocking how widespread it is, and it's another... another drug problem that America has to deal with. It's a different one, but pharmaceuticals, you know, they're the ones that are responsible for that.
It's so big that here, my wife pointed this out to me, and then we'll move on to some crime stuff, folks, but it's so big that they even have a national commercial for opioid-induced diarrhea, I mean, induced constipation, and everybody's seen it. And it got this good-looking, you know, tough, middle-aged, working kind of a guy, and he has opioid-induced constipation. And I just, when I saw that, what that was, I just said, it's done. We're done, folks. We just got on the board with the drug addiction.
Yeah. Well, so this is actually crime we're talking about, you know, because you have people that are hooked on opioids.
Yeah.
They do crimes. So they support their habits.
That's true.
A lot of white collar crimes.
That's the overall picture. So,
anyhow, we've kind of gone through that. We talked about cocaine a lot. So let's talk about narcos, and which is I have to agree with you about that. Pablo Escobar, he drew all the heat. He was like a lightning rod for law enforcement from you know, in both the northern and southern hemisphere, and became this larger-than-life character, and they devoted all their resources to him. And at the same time, here this Cali cartel was quietly working behind the scenes and were ready to move into the the forefront. So tell us a little bit about that Cali cartel.
Yeah, you know, they both rose at the same time, the Medellin cartel and the Cali cartel in the 1970s. They started off with marijuana. And then when cocaine became big, you know, cocaine was historically known as the champagne of drugs because only rich, you know, people like entertainers, politicians, you know, et cetera, could afford it. But then by the late 70s, you know, they were mass producing it. They were getting it easily to the United States to move around. So cocaine becoming big, and that led to the rise of these two cartels. And at first they worked, you know, there was enough space for everybody. You know, they worked together. You know, they didn't mind each other, you know, operating in almost the same space. And then Escobar, he started to get delusions of grandeur. You know, he thought he could be a politician, you know, and he was embarrassed when he was exposed as a drug trafficker. He thought he could brutalize the state into submission, you know, by committing ultra-violence and all that. And it became a situation where, you know, the struggle for the survival of Colombia as a democracy came at stake. Colombia was the Iraq before Iraq, you know, in the early 2000s, you know, when after 9/11, when the U.S. Took on Saddam. It was the same way. It was, you know, there were bombings all over the place. Killings and Escobar operated a lot like Al Zawahiri, you know, the famous a terrorist that operated in Iraq about 10 years ago. The Cali cartel quietly operated behind the scenes because their style was they'd rather prefer the drive to the bullet, and for Escobar it was the reverse. It reached a point where they were drawn into it as well, and they had to fight for their survival. This was in the late 1980s. So they actually joined forces with the legitimate forces, you know, the U.S. security forces and the Colombian government, and they provided the intelligence which helped to take down Escobar. But I think in the back of their minds they knew that once Escobar went down, they'd be the next target, because that's historically been the way it's been done. You know, the U.S. has focused on kingpins, right?
Right.
And there's good reason for that. You get more money, you know, if you focus on a target, because it's be explicit, and you get more credit too. You know, you could brag in the papers and all that, but it doesn't really do anything. Look at Al Guzman, right? Chapo Al Guzman, the Mexican that was extradited to the U.S. It's still the same thing in Mexico. It's still going on and all that. But they were the target. U.S. Went after them. It's a long, involved story. You'll see part of it in Narcos. I don't know how accurate it'll be, but you'll see a part of it this season 3. They were taken down, very close to turning Colombia into a narco-democracy. And if it wasn't for the discovery of a narco cassette, which revealed that the Cali cartel had put in $6 million into the campaign of Ernesto Samper, who was a presidential candidate, he actually won. But when he won, he had to prove that he wasn't corrupt, right? So he became an even more ardent force against the Cali cartel, and ironically. And so they were eventually brought down, extradited to the United States. But nothing changed. I mean,
really?
All the only thing that happened after these two big cartels were taken down, the Medellin and the Cali cartel, was that it shifted to Mexico and the U.S. border.
Yeah.
Right. It shifted from Colombia, which was in South America, to very close to us now, where you have Mexican cartels operating in 200 U.S. cities, according to the USDEA, and you have the violence that is as bad, if not worse, than what happened in Colombia. You know, thousands of police and soldiers have been murdered, journalists murdered, citizens on the street murdered, towns turned into fortress cities for drug cartels, and as we said earlier, nothing has changed, right?
Right,
it's still the same thing.
It is interesting.
Played over and over again.
Mexico, you know, the headlines coming out of Mexico. I hadn't been so many real recently, but there for a while, it was just like down in Colombia during the
80s. Yeah, it's still the same way. But you know, they got rid of Chapo, You know, he's taken off out of the picture, but they're, I guess they're waiting for the next big kingpin. Once he emerges,
there's always somebody waiting in the wings.
Yeah,
exactly. But it's, you know, it's business as usual for the cartels right now, and the violence is still going on. It's still the same. And, you know, the press hasn't focused on it because there isn't such a charismatic guy like El Chapo Guzman, right?
Yeah, or Escobar.
And there will, eventually somebody will emerge.
Right.
You know, but the cartels are sorting things out right now.
But, you know, and law enforcement and the public and law enforcement reflects the public, and the press is going to reflect what the public wants. We like this bigger than life character to go after and to take down.
Exactly.
It's like an instinctual kind of a thing. I know the feeling. You want to go after the big kingpin so you can take him down and put, you know, 10 kilos or 100 kilos or 500 kilos on the table and a bunch of guns and money and say, look what we did, then go on to the next one. I understand that. I live that life.
And then, you know, you're fighting with other government agencies for money, right?
Right. Then
you show at the end, say, hey, I took this big guy down. He was in the paper all the time, you know, running wild in Mexico, and we took him down, you know.
Yep. Hey, going back to the Cali cartel and their political influence, I'm always kind of interested in how they do that. And I realize it's not like the United States. It's maybe like the United States was back in the 30s, where politicians and the organized crime were, you know, a lot closer.
It operated that way, Gary. It really did. I mean, it was very similar to the way it operated. I mean, they bribed an incredible number of politicians. That's why it was so hard to get an extradition treaty passed, you know. And they did it very quietly, you know, with the implicit threat that, you know, if you don't cooperate with us, something will happen to you or your family. And the Cali cartel, you know, has a reputation for being the gentleman from Cali. You hear that, you know. And but they were just as violent as Escobar, or they could be, and they would take out everybody. You know, your family, your dogs,
wow,
and anybody close to you. And so there was that threat, and they operated quietly without the spectacularness of Escobar, and they corrupted all kinds of politicians around their payroll.
What was the saying that Escobar had in Spanish? You probably know in Spanish. It's
better a grave in Colombia than a jail cell in the United States.
Yeah, that. But there's another one: silver or lead.
Plato Plumo.
Plato Plumo, right?
Right. It was the Colombian, you know, the Colombian Express. It was actually a press came up with it.
Oh, really?
You know, to describe what your options were when you dealt with the cartels.
Well, probably the cartel picked it up from the press and then would go back around to some local politician and say, you know, silver or lead, which you want, bud?
Yeah, they have, the Colombian press is pretty inventive. They had the world's greatest outlaw, you know, that expression that they used for Escobar.
Interesting.
You can't beat that, right?
No, a great moniker makes the man when it comes to being in the mob or being in crime. You know, if you don't have a good moniker, you don't get really the kind of coverage in the press. But,
exactly.
I mean, these guys still had to operate in this country, and you're talking about a drug production. I mean, you know, there's an element of in Colombia where they're actually, you know, if you're a farmer and you either can take the silver or the lead. You know, part of that is, you know, you're trying to make a living.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. And, you know, and we don't realize how much of the economy illicit drugs sustained. At one time, I saw the figure that the cartels were employing in the Andes, you know, region, which included, you know, Venezuela, Bolivia, and all that, 600,000 people. 600,000 people were employed. Well, you figure what they need. They need accountants, right? They need truck drivers. They need, hitman.
Yep.
You know, they need journalists on their payroll to write
farmers,
farmhands,
farmers.
Farmers, to plant the coca and grow it and all that. And so it was vital. What's amazing is that Colombia has turned out to be more of a success story. The violence has subsided considerably. When I started going there in the late 80s, I couldn't go like 10 miles outside the city because the guerrillas were operating, and it was, very dangerous, and you could easily be kidnapped and, held for ransom and all that. So, the family of my wife, wouldn't let me go out. But today, one of the top destinations for American retirees, according to the ARP and some of the other things I've seen, is Medellin, Colombia, the stronghold of Escobar. They actually say that's one of the best places for Americans to retire for a variety of reasons. That shows you how it's changed, in the last 10 or 15 years.
I was just thinking that he was, if you were down there and you went outside of town, you would be like, don't shoot me, I'm Canadian.
Yeah.
Wouldn't matter. You look like a gringo. I don't think it would
matter.
Way.
Yeah, but do you always put a Canadian flag on your backpack or whatever when you're traveling? I would.
I would.
You're still a gringo,
Yeah. Well, when you're...
It's like trying to identify an African from Somalia and Sudan, right?
Yeah. Well, they'll let you know.
It's not going to make you much difference.
All you got to do is start talking.
Yeah, exactly.
So your wife is from there. She has family there in Colombia. You write these books. And, I know working with Gary, sometimes the topics are, to say they're dangerous for us, they're topics that maybe some people don't want people talking about. Obviously, in Mexico, there's been journalists that have been decapitated, and they make it very public that they don't want you to talk about this stuff. Do you, you don't feel any, concern? For your own personal safety.
I was always very careful. I've reported from 35 countries. I was in Nicaragua when the Contras and the Sandinistas were fighting. I was in Northern Ireland when Bobby Sands, the famous IRA prisoner, committed suicide in the early 80s. It was really, really hairy there. I was in Bangladesh when the Iraq War broke out. I was teaching there as a Fulbright scholar. And I've never really had a serious situation where someone has, where I felt I was in danger. Now, in Cuba, I was detained by the security forces because I was picked up by visa. I lied on my visa. I told them I was a librarian, but I came in as a journalist, and I was interviewing some dissidents, and they were trailing me and trailing them, and they brought me in, and they gave me 48 hours to get out of Cuba. This was back in 89, and I got out in 24 hours to do that. But outside, of that, I had a gun pulled at me once in Northern Ireland, but it wasn't really directed at me. It was sort of a guy who was asking me a weird question, what I thought of the local situation. And I guess he was looking for me to give the right answer because he had the gun. He was a Protestant extremist. But, outside of a few incidents like that, I guess I've been lucky in a way, but also I've been very careful. I'm not crazy. Situation, I wouldn't go 10 miles outside of Bogota because they told me not to do that, when it was really hairy there. And I think that's important,
So when you were in Ireland and that guy asked you that question, I guess you didn't genuflect.
Well, I did some fast talking.
I did some fast talking. You did some quick Protestant talking.
I got a little Irish in me. The Irish are great talkers. I got a little Irish in me. I talked by example because I was living in Ireland for years. So
there you go.
Very, very good, yeah.
Seems like it'd be kind of difficult. You have to look for the cross or whatever. Sure which way you're going to go on this one.
Start talking about John Calvin and Presbyterianism.
So going back to the Cali cartel, these guys, multi-million-dollar operations, and where are they?
$1 billion.
Yeah, $1 billion. Where are they today then?
Well, it's weird. There were actually four of them that formed sort of like the board of directors of this federation, a loose federation called the Cali cartel. Two of them, Pacho Herrera and Jose Santa Cruz Londoño, they nicknamed him Chepe, died. Herrera died in prison. Someone killed him. And then Chepe was on the run after the Cali cartel went down, and he was killed as well. And the two brothers, Gilberto and Miguel Rodriguez Orihuela, were extradited to the U.S. And ironically, Gilberto is about, I think he's about 3 hours from me in a South Carolina prison, the last time I checked. And the other brother is in North Carolina in a prison there. And I've been thinking, hey, maybe I should just write them a letter, ask them if they'd be available for an interview.
Put a little money on their books.
Well, they've never been, nothing. They never talked since they've been incarcerated. There's just been no really real stories about them, how they're doing. Roberto was pretty sick when he went in, and it's amazing he's still alive. He's about late 70s now, I'd be curious to hear what they have to say after all this time.
It would be worth a shot.
It's worth a shot, which I've done. I've done that before. I've been lucky on a few occasions. I've been unlucky in getting an interview on a lot of occasions, but I always say all it takes is a letter, right?
That's all it takes.
A short letter. Yeah, and see what happens.
So one question that keeps sticking in my mind. You mentioned something about this political thing about a cassette tape that came to light when they donated $6 million and got to help get the president of the country elected. What was the story behind this tape that came to light?
Well, the tape is really interesting. Andres Pastrana was on the stump, and I interviewed Andres Pastrana, by the way. I interviewed Samper too. I interviewed him three times, the president that was on the payroll of the Cali cartel. But Pastrana showed up at a rally in a city, I believe it was Cartagena, and somebody just handed him the cassette, handed it to him, and then it became public. But it was too late to change the election, and he lost by a hair, in the election, and Samper became president. But that became a scandal. Because you had it right there on tape that the Cali cartel were influencing the election. And so Samper had to try to prove he wasn't on the take. So, this bizarre situation where he became really tough, looking like the guy that was leading the fight against the Cali cartel, and probably played a key role in helping to bring him down.
Interesting. What was it, like a wiretap or something? Somebody had tapped his phone or wore a wire on him?
It was like a conversation. I don't know I can't remember exactly what the details were, but it was like a conversation where somebody from the cartel was talking about putting $6 million in the campaign to influence it.
Oh, I got you now. Interesting.
Well, that might be interesting to try to get that tape and dissect it a little bit.
That's interesting. What would happen to it? It's I'm a former archivist, too, which means I preserve history.
It's got to be out there somewhere.
It's got to be out there somewhere preserved because it's really a key document in Colombian history. So I don't know if the DA's got it or if the Colombian government's got it. I'm sure the DA's probably got a copy of it somewhere in their vaults.
Yeah, I wonder if you could identify it. I've done a few FOIA requests. You probably have, too. If you can identify that tape the way they've got it, in their files, you can just ask for that tape, and I would think they'd have to give it to you.
Yeah. You know, FOIA requests are weird.
Yeah, I know.
You'll get things you think you'll get, and then they won't send you things you think, and then when they send you stuff, it's heavily redacted, right?
Yes, I know.
I mean, all kinds of stuff. I actually made a request for the Cali cartel, and I sort of forgot about it, and the stuff came that they sent 3 years after I finished the book.
Oh.
3 years. It didn't have that much that I could have used, but there was a couple of things I probably could have used for the book and all that. But, I mean, it's up to them. They call it Freedom Information Request, right? Ironic title.
Yeah.
but there's a little freedom because transaction, because it's really up to the government agency to decide what they're going to do,
I feel your pain, brother. I've got a guy who hung himself in Leavenworth up here, and I've got the hot copy of the FBI report that shows he did. So I make a request, FOIA request, to the prisons system, and they come back and they claim they don't have anything on the guy. So, and I had his inmate number, I had his date of birth, and
you know they're lying.
Proof of his death and everything. I don't know why they're lying, but there's some. I don't know what the deal is, but I'm thinking about appealing it. Yeah, I think I'll appeal it. I just haven't got around to it yet, just to see how what happens.
Well, it takes so much time.
Yeah, I know.
It takes so much. You have to spend an enormous amount of energy to fight with them to get to get access to that stuff, and you wonder if it's worth it, you know?
Yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you probably one more question. We've been here about an hour or so, haven't we? Aaron, how long?
Like 45 minutes. I've been kind of resetting the...
So I'm curious about the breakdown now. If I read up on this a little bit, that one of those, the four gentlemen of distinction, or the Cali cartel, one went to New York and set up distribution networks, and one was their enforcement.
I talk about that in my book, Drug Lords, and it's also in Narcos too. That was Chepe Santa Cruz, Jose Santa Cruz Londoño. He was sent by the cartel, and he set up a network. And it was very logical, because there's about almost a million Colombians living in New York City. You know, you go to Queens, there's all kinds of Colombian connections, travel agencies, restaurants, etc. And so there was a natural base, right, in which to form an organization. And historically, Miami became Escobar's stronghold, and New York City became the Cali cartel stronghold. And so that's where their strength came from in the United States.
Now, did they set it up kind of like, and Escobar, he started bringing everything in through Florida, and somebody was bringing a lot up through L.A. That's where, in Kansas City, by the 80s, later 80s.
He used every possible way to get it in, and it shifted. As soon as law enforcement closed down one possible avenue, it opened up another, right? They were using big boats, for example, going down the East Coast, delivering stuff in concrete, fish tanks, etc., all that. When they closed that down, they moved to the Mexican border, right?
Yeah.
And, it just shifted. It shifted around, and that's in this history of the war on drugs. You know, a cat and mouse game, which never seems to end, and law enforcement never seems to make any progress.
Well, that's true. As long as there's demand, there is no progress can be made.
Exactly. As long as you have somebody, and of course, that's really ticked off people in Latin America, right? They say, "Why are we paying for the United States hunger for drugs?"
Really?
You know, and they blame us, and there's some truth to that.
Well, they could grow coffee instead.
There's not a, yeah.
You can't get $50,000 or $20,000 for a kilo of coffee.
Yeah.
You know, the supply and demand principle works both ways. Why grow coffee when you can grow coca?
Yeah, really. And you probably make more money.
Make much more money. If there's a demand for it, you know, it creates the supply or the supplier.
That's what I've all long said this about Mexico. I'm kind of I've been to Mexico several times and even tried to study Spanish down there, stayed down there and lived with a family for a couple of weeks and have this interest in Mexico. And I just keep, and this was in the 90s, and I kept thinking, you know, if somehow this economy could take off a little bit, I don't understand why we have such a powerful economy and have all these job opportunities and they don't in Mexico. Because those guys, they don't really want to come up to the United States, and they don't want most of them don't want to be part of any drug organization. They just want to have
myth.
A good job.
Every Mexican, every person in a third world country wants to come here.
Yeah.
They want to make it in their own country if you give an opportunity.
That's
they don't
want
to come to
them. But those questions are all bigger than us, I think. So, that's my two cents worth on the war on drugs. And I always say that I was once a soldier in Ronnie Reagan's war on drugs, and we lost. So,
we're a soldier. Were you a captain or a sergeant?
Yeah, I was a sergeant. I had a tax squad. We served the high-risk search warrants for the narcs. And narcs went out and did all the buys, and then we'd come in behind them and serve the search warrants and help catalog the stuff and do gather intelligence and follow people around for them when we weren't serving a search warrant. It was a lot of fun for a young man. But yeah.
I know when I do hashtags, I always call Gary a detective, even though he served at a higher rank. People, if you said mob sergeant, people would be like, what's that mean? But if you say mob detective, they know what you're talking about.
Really?
But he's done some pretty amazing things.
Ways, maybe mob detective could mean being on the payroll too, right?
Yeah, really. We had the mob detectives, but it was Appolito, and I can't remember the other guy's name. That was an embarrassment for law enforcement nationwide.
Oh, yeah. There's been cases like that over the years, hasn't there?
Really?
Well, right. I would think much like the mob, you know, the Colombians here, they were, you know, these guys would infiltrate the organizational structures of their opponents and, you know, paying off the guy that became the president was, you know, turned out not quite as well as they thought it would. But, you know, you got to get your product across the borders and, you know, you don't want people to be looking underneath the tarps or looking at your, you know, concrete fish tanks.
You know, I once had a really good informant. He was one of the better informants I ever had, and he had a stolen car network. And now he was always picking my brain as much as I was picking his. And I once told him, I said, dude, because what he'd do, he would go out and he'd find the car almost on order that would be sitting in an apartment parking lot or parked on the street somewhere.
Yeah.
And he'd get in it and he would there back in the 70s, he would get a key code out of it. He'd go make a key. He went to locksmithing school. He'd go make a key. He hired another guy then to go get that car about 4 o'clock in the morning and drive it to a farm that he had rented about 50 miles out of town. And he had another guy that would then cut that into pieces. And then he had connections with body shops all over the Midwest. And then they would put in orders for, you know, a front clip or a left door or right door to a certain kind of a car. And he had all these balls in the air all the time. And finally, they had a little error down on the farm, and the rural police came storming in and exposed the whole thing. And that guy took him down. But I'd once told him, I said, dude, if you would just put all this managerial skill and effort to something legal, I said, you'd do good. He said, yeah, but he said it wouldn't be as much fun. So go figure.
Well, you could count the number of guys that got away with crime on your one hand, almost. You know what I mean? That didn't spend time in prison or didn't get killed. You know, Matthews is on the fence. By the way, he could either be dead or he could be, you know, free. But most every criminal eventually gets caught or dies, right?
Yeah, they do.
Crime does not pay. That cliche, crime does not pay, is exactly true.
Wait, that's not completely true because you as a true crime author.
We're making money off of it.
I know. Now he's not going to hear me as
well. You're right. I mean, that's probably should be amended. That statement. So, when you look at U.S. Congress, right?
Yeah, really.
I mean, crime paid Gary's bills for 25 years, but he was on the law enforcement side of things.
Yeah.
Now, I guess because you're a true crime author, you also have a publishing company. We didn't touch on that.
Yeah, strategicmediabooks.com. We've got several books on true crime your listeners might be interested in. Three or four of them have been optioned for movies. And they can go to www.strategicmediabooks.com if you're interested. Strategicmediabooks.com.
And then you have a personal website?
Yeah, it's www.ronchepsik, ronchepesiuk.com.
All right, and then your Crime Beat radio show. Now, what's the easiest way for people, and I'll put links up, but what's the easiest way for people?
The way to go there is go to the artistfirst.com website. Artist, A-R-T-I-S-T, first.com. And look for the scroll until you get the Crime Beat show and click on it. And all our shows are archived for 24/7 listening. You just get on it. It's MP3. Just click on it, and you can listen to the show. And we go back to January 26, 2011. And we've had some really wild guests on the show, including your great host, Harry Jenkins.
I see you had Joe Pistone on there. I heard him on. There's an FBI.
We,
eye agent that has a podcast, and I heard him on there. He is a good guest. I was impressed with.
Yeah, he's a good guest. You can probably, if you're interested in trying to get him on, I can give you the agent's name.
Okay.
And, email. You can email me, and
I'll do that. I'll do that.
He's a very nice guy. He was on the show, and I've had Henry Hill.
Yeah, I see you had Henry Hill. What was that like? A lot of you guys may not know who Henry Hill was by that name, but he was the Ray Liotta character.
This website published this publicity, and Henry read it, and he didn't like the way it sounded, and he threatened to not come on the show.
No, really?
And all that. I assured him that had nothing to do with the blurb that came on that website, and finally we talked him in, and it turned out to be a great guest.
Yeah, I've seen him talk. He's a character.
Yeah,
isn't he?
I would think he's got some great stories.
I had George Jung, another character, Blow. Blow that. That was.
Yeah.
With Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp. Yeah, that was a heck of a story.
Yeah, and I had Robert Kennedy Jr. on.
Oh, really?
You say, what's Robert Kennedy Jr. doing on your show? He wrote a book about true crime.
He did.
Michael Scalzi, his cousin, was in prison. Convicted of killing this young woman, and he wrote a book. Very good book, by the way. And he came on. And talked about it. 2 weeks ago, I had F.E. Bailey on, which was quite a treat. Bailey's been associated with some of the really great true crime stories over the years. The Boston Strangler,
yep.
Sam Shepard, Patty Hearst, O.J. Simpson, and so that was great. That's one of the benefits of having a crime show like this, right, Gary?
Because yeah.
We're not going to get rich, but we meet a lot of interesting.
That's true. Characters. That's what Aaron tells me all the time. He said, one thing about this, he says, we meet the most interesting people on this show.
Exactly, exactly. And everybody's got a story, and most of them can tell it well.
That's true. All right, I think we're pretty well done. You got any other questions, Aaron?
Anything coming out in the future that people might want to look for?
I'm working on screenplays. I've got one in development now. I'm getting the script in shape with the production company that's working. I can't tell too much about it now, but maybe you can have me on some other day in the future. And this other script, too, is in development. I'm waiting for the go-ahead on that. And I've got, three books, four books, actually, optioned for movies, and we're hoping something to happen with them. So it's a pretty exciting time right now. And
looking
forward to the future because I'll be writing screenplays, not too many books, because that's where I think I want to go with my writing career at this stage of my life.
And your true crime podcast itself, you can listen to live on, you said Thursday nights?
Yes, Thursday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
All right, great. Well, Ron, it's been great having you on here. I think we'll
Thank you.
Let you get
Gary
on back
and Aaron, very much.
All right. Good night, Ron.
Thank you.
Okay, good night then. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Well, maybe he'll end up with one of his option books turned into a movie, and then we'll have this interview before the movie comes out.
We will. We will. Matter of fact, if he gets a book, I kind of follow what he does anyhow. And if I see one coming up where he's going to have a movie, I'll give him a call and we'll get him back on here. He's a good guy. I remember that from when I was on his show.
Yeah, how was that when you were on his show?
It was, it's kind of like we do with him. He asked me about the movie, about my background and about my movie, and so I told him about the movie and the story behind it and who I was, and then it was done. It was 2013.
How long was the interview? Maybe 35, 45 minutes?
It was so long ago. I've done so much since then. I would say somewhere between 30 minutes and an hour.
Maybe when you go back, because you put together the show notes for the episode and release it, maybe you can...
I'll see if I can't find that. He said he had his shows archived. I'll have to go back
and
look.
Maybe you can find that and add a link to that so folks can go back and listen to you talk about, you be interviewed by somebody else instead of being the interviewer.
That's a good idea, Aaron. It's a good idea. Now, that whole drug thing, it's good to see people who have some influence or understanding that the war on drugs it needs to be different. It needs to be changed. And so that's... I was really glad to hear that. He's a guy that a lot of people follow him. I think he told me once he had like 100,000 listeners on, you know, selected shows on his radio show. So he's pretty well known.
Well, having done it that long.
Yeah.
I mean, we've 2.5 years or so we've been doing this episodes, and he said 2011.
Yes.
So, I mean, he's really way ahead of the curve.
He was one of the early adopters of this true crime radio podcast thing. He goes way back. Now all the big companies are starting to get into it and have their own true crime podcast trying to knock us little guys out. So you guys, you want to keep us on the air out there, you need to give us some help once in a while, and you can go to my website, www.ganglandwire.com, and go to the shop page or the donate page and donate. Aaron and I were talking, what was it? We just thought if we could get a quarter an episode, that'd be like $1 a month from each one of you guys.
You can subscribe and become one of our made members.
Yes.
Now, we set that up for you, or you can make a one-time donation. And if you do that, we've got some little tchotchkes, some bonus episodes and things like that Gary would send you, along with our undying thanks and maybe a mention on an episode of Gangland Wire.
Yeah. And
if you donate enough, actually, we would call you and do a special interview with you.
That's true. You just tell me what you want when you make your donation, and I'll tell you what I'll give you in the end, but you'll get something, that's for sure. We just had an email from Dean in Ireland. He gave us I told him I want to get some different accents. You know, if you guys are listening to us, which you are, you know, every once in a while we'll have a little lead-in and say, my name's so-and-so, and you're listening to Gangland Wire. And this guy's from Ireland. We had a guy from Scotland, and now we've got a guy from Ireland. We need somebody from England. We like to get those different accents. Just call my phone, 816-931-3535, and when it goes to message, just say, hi, my name is Aaron Gunnerk, and I'm calling from jolly old England, and we love Gangland Wire over here, or something like that.
You could actually probably even record it on your computer right there if you have like a little mic, you know.
Right. You could report it on your computer and then just email me the file.
If you're overseas on your phone and attach it as an email and send it to ganglandwire@gmail.com.
Right.
And we'll put those in.
There's a variety of different ways you can do it. I'm glad you said that because Dean had some way to call directly from Ireland to the United States, but everybody probably doesn't have that on their phone. Everybody's got internet email.
Yeah. Like Skype is a way that we can get international calls, but we don't actually have a Skype number. But you'd have to find Gangland Wire on Skype, and you could do it that way.
Yeah,
but
that's true, too.
The other thing that folks can do is if you've got a business and you want to advertise, like we've got these Jurassic Jerky. I don't know if we're still putting those in, if it's going to be on the front end of this episode.
It probably will. I think I forgot on the last one. I have a story about that, Aaron. So Dean from Ireland, and he emails me. Just before that, he says, well, what is jerky? He said, I've always heard of it, but he didn't know what jerky was. So I don't know if that's purely an American thing. I told him, I said, you know, it's dried beef or dried pork or mainly dried beef. And my knowledge of it came from our early, you know, Western explorers got it from Indians who would dry buffalo meat and
into strips
and put salt on it, and it was preserved that way, and so you'd have something to eat without having to refrigerate it.
Yeah.
So I think that, I don't know if it was invented by the Indians in the United States.
But I think before that, like in England, they had, wouldn't they have like salted pork?
They probably did. They probably had something like
really
that.
Something really heavily salted meats.
They just didn't call it jerky.
Yeah. But Jurassic Jerky, an advertiser that we kind of hooked up with. I saw they followed you on Twitter.
Oh, did they?
I thought I was looking, because sometimes I'll go through my personal account if you want to follow that. It's Aaron Gunnerk, AaronGNIRK. And, of course, Gary is Jenks Law.
At Jenks Law or at Gangland Wire.
Yeah, give us a follow on the Twitter for Gangland Wire because we need those.
Yeah, we don't have many because I don't ever pump it. I'm not very good. I'm pretty good on Instagram.
One tweet on that one, but what I'll do is I'll go back to yours and see if there's anybody recently who's followed you.
Yeah.
And depending, I may follow them. And I noticed that Jurassic Turkey looked like they were following you, so I followed them. But if you're if you have a product, I don't know, it's one of those things where depending on the nature of your product, if you buy it on the internet, obviously, you know, we've been pretty popular. as people downloading the episodes, and I think we've got a reasonable price for an ad that would go on the front end of the episode. Maybe this one you're listening to, if you got in touch with us.
You go
to advertisecast.com. We got in with a package deal with some other, I don't know if it was Sword and Scale, some other, you know, sometimes they'll do, you can do a buy and get in with a group of podcasts.
Right.
Or you can just get a buy for us specifically.
Right. That would be a good deal to be part of a group of different true crime podcasters, because we all kind of have the same audience, more or less. And I don't know how much longer we'll keep that Jurassic Jerky thing on there. Here we're giving them all kinds of free publicity, Aaron, and we haven't. I don't think we haven't made a dime off of it yet. And we may not. It's not a big deal. And I don't really want to burden people with a bunch of advertising. Although here's what Dean said: because of the way you did it, and the way we did that K&N oil filter thing, we kind of, you know, we make it entertaining.
Yeah.
He said, I'll have to admit, he said, that's the one advertisement that I have actually listened to.
The K&N or the...
No, the Jurassic Jerky. It's a kind of a fun one.
I know. Because I was thinking, what I really probably need to do, too, is to get a copy of it from you to see what you cut it down to.
Yeah.
Because I could put it into my little repertoire of... Hey, well, this, if you want to get Aaron Gennert to do voiceover work for you, here
that's
a
good
sample. Although I totally, there was no copy to read. I simply was kind of riffing.
Riffing.
I was improvising a copy and looking at their website. And
all right. Well, what are we going to do? What are we going to talk about next time, Aaron? What have I can't remember what I've got in the, I'm going to put this one up pretty quick, I think. Well, we'll see. I don't know. I've got a bunch of them in the pipeline. We have a new chief of police in Kansas City, folks, a guy named Rick Smith, and one of our guests on here that worked a case on the 51st Street Crips, a guy named Jim Harrington. I've talked to both of them. They're both really busy with different projects, but they both worked a case on one of the largest jewelry theft in Kansas City, and they solved it, and they took down a couple of mob-associated fences with it. So I put the word out to them and told them that they just need to come together at a time and come in. They both want to do it. It's just a matter of getting time to come in and do it. So that would be cool to have the chief of police of Kansas City come in and tell about a story of his early career. I know he wants to do it.
And I could personally thank him for his help over at Chubby's on Broadway previously.
You could.
And then bend his ear about this recent incident. I did tell my manager, I said, you can talk to the district manager and he can tell you whatever story he wants about that last event and why those guys got, why they got, you know, the felon who had guns got pulled back into jail. But I think that, we got a friend in this gentleman.
You do.
You said read back through the profile of the incident, and you know the guy makes threats and
right. Yeah, so what's he doing out on the street?
Comes back with a gun, and they just fortunately catch him before he walks in the restaurant to start blowing people away.
Well, what we got now, our new chief of police is a policeman's police. He's a real policeman. Lots of times, as a chief, you get a guy who came on, worked in the field for about 2 years until he can in a safe place until he can get out and then go up through all the different administrative functions, and so they know how to play politics and are more likely to get advanced education and not get out there on the streets and take risks and do real police work. But Rick is a guy that did the deal, longtime TAC guy, robbery detective sergeant. TAC captain, TAC supervisor, that's the SWAT teams, and so he's a real policeman, as I say.
Somebody you worked with it back in the day?
Well, he was a little bit younger than me, so I had been to a lot of those places and then had moved on to someplace else, and by the time he came along. Anyhow, if you've got a friend or relative with a problem, drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. That's our public service announcement. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to go out to ganglandwire.com, share, subscribe, support the podcast True Crime Episodes from the Mouth of the Men That Did It. Gary Jenkins, obviously a longtime servant of the public in the police department here in Kansas City, Missouri, and he is an author and he is a documentary filmmaker. You want to go out to Amazon and get the documentary that started it all, Gang Gangland Wire, available for purchase for like $7. And then get the book he just recently finished here, January, February. I think he finished that episode or that book up, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps took down mob dominant, or how FBI... How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And when you're reading the book, you got to get the Kindle version so you can actually listen to the words from the mouth of the men that did it. And then get the app, Kansas City Mob Tour. You, for $1.99, can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.